Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
If you need the money over the next couple of years, you need to get that money out and in your hands where it's not going to be at risk of major losses in the stock market.
As news of the U.S. financial crisis hit, professors at the University of Connecticut in the Economics and Political Science Department held an impromptu forum, and through only word-of-mouth promotion, the forum hall was packed. Topics included the benefits or disadvantages of market regulation, comparing the current crisis to the 1930s and the Depression era, Treasury Secretary Paulson's $700 billion bailout plan for Wall Street, versus new ideas that were surfacing even as Congress voted on the plan. Students who asked a lot of questions were told that there could indeed be rising housing costs in the event that they were seeking off-campus housing, and information was provided on the increasing difficulty for students trying to obtain credit through credit cards or student loan dollars. Now, during a presidential debate held in Nashville, Democratic Senator Barack Obama mentioned the need to help students twice.
We are mortgaging our children's future. We've got to have a different energy plan. We've got to invest in college affordability. So we're going to have to make some investments, but we've also got to make spending cuts. And what I've proposed, you'll hear Senator McCain say, well, he's proposing a whole bunch of new spending, but actually I am cutting more than I'm spending.
Joining us to talk about all of this is Dr. Stephen L. Ross of the University of Connecticut's Economic Department, where he teaches in the area of public finance and has research interests in areas like housing, real estate, politics, and urban economics. Professor Ross, welcome.
Hello.
Let me start by asking you what kinds of things students and their families should know as they try to look at their economic situation and, you know, deal with this crisis.
I'm not an expert on college. I'm more of an expert on the mortgage market. But one of the things I do know about financing a college education is the importance of loans today, and not just government-guaranteed loans. And what many students might not know is that the student loan market is structured very much like the mortgage market. Just like in the mortgage market, where loans are bundled, turned into securities which are sold on a secondary market, the same thing happens with student loans. So, in fact, the student loan market started being affected by this credit crunch over a year ago. Many students may have already experienced some difficulty getting student loans last fall and spring, and there are a number of stories on the news. With the continued tightening of credit markets this fall, it's very likely that the student loan market will be even more difficult during the coming year in terms of students finding financing from banks for their student loans. And so you're going to have to start early in terms of trying to find a student loan because you don't know whether your traditional lender is going to work out or not. And the sooner you start, the more time you have. And that's probably the best piece of advice I can give. You know, if students are unable to get loans, I don't have much good advice. You suggested when we spoke earlier that students often rely on revolving credit card debt to try to make the difference between what they've gotten in terms of student loans and financial aid. That is never a good strategy, and it's because the interest rates are so expensive. You know, if you imagine someone builds up $5,000 of credit card debt during 1 year, that alone would have them paying $1,000 in interest the next year, and that can spiral over 3 or 4 years. Further, it's more than likely that credit card debt itself is going to start being restricted over the next few months as the credit markets tighten. And while I would expect students will still be able to get credit cards, it's not going to be like the days when people would just mail you credit cards with a $15,000, $20,000 cap on it. I think credit card companies can be much more careful about what the credit limits on the cards are going to be, and you're going to see limits more like $2,000 and $3,000 as people are getting their initial card. I don't think credit cards are really going to provide much in the way of an escape valve for students who are having trouble finding student loans. So I don't have a lot of help here. I just want to really emphasize start early because you might need to approach more than one lender. And your best bet is to really sort of turn over every rock. Start early with the lender you've worked with. If that doesn't work, go to your parents' bank. If that doesn't work, look on the web and try lender after lender because obviously getting your student loan is extraordinarily important for most students to be able to continue the next year of college. I don't want to encourage students not to go to college. The fact is that going to college in the long run provides a tremendous return on the financial investment. It's well documented that the return on going to college is very robust, and comparing it to the return people are getting on the stock market right now, it's downright wonderful. Hopefully most parents who've been saving for college move that money out of the stock market as they approach the time for sending their kids to college. But I understand that some students or some parents are using like retirement funds and things like that as sort of security or collateral for parental loan. You're probably going to see more parental co-signing on loans to keep the kids in college as credit standards tighten. You might see more students working and maybe slowing down their college career. Obviously, it's hard to find jobs when the economy is in a downturn. Truth be told, when the economy slows like this is when students actually are more likely to go to college. The decision to go to college is really one of trading off what you can earn right now in the labor market versus the benefits of spending more time getting an education. During when there's a recession, that's when people usually say, hey, the labor market's not paying well. Let's actually spend some time investing in education. With the tightening credit market, it's going to be much harder to do that this year than next. One thing students might really look for in terms of politics, I think student organizations and parents maybe want to be talking to their representatives. This goes back to the bailout bill, which had a lot of tax breaks for various companies and had a major bailout for the financial sector, and the question was, what was it going to do for people who were in the mortgage market? Well, I think a similar question should be asked about student loans. We've just had a $700 billion bailout. The government is out there buying commercial paper so that companies can run their day-to-day operations. Maybe the government should be expanding their student loan programs. If the government is willing to buy debt of corporations, maybe they should be willing to buy more debt of students so that students can go to college.
We should mention here that students can go online to the websites of their colleges to learn about ways to pay for tuition. We have a call in to UConn, and we expect to hear from them this week. But we also noted that Eastern Connecticut State University has teamed up with Tuition Pay for a monthly payment plan that is interest-free. It allows you to spread your tuition and fees over a number of months. I'm sure UConn will have more advice for students as the crisis becomes more clear. When you talk about dispensing funds from either the state or federal government, you have to have money to dispense, right? And if people are losing money, they might not have as big a tax base, and they're in the state's and federal government's income might go down, right?
Well, one thing to realize, of course, is all of this is paid for by debt, right? And so the real issue is one where there is a lot of liquidity, there is a lot of capital in the market, and that capital has decided to sit on the sidelines, right? The capital has said, we don't know what the future holds. We want to sit on the sidelines unless there are very, very safe places for us to put our money. What the government is essentially doing with the bailout is they're saying there's tons of capital, but none of these people who control this capital are willing to provide it to anybody who wants to do something productive. They're sort of sitting on it because they're scared. So if we can provide treasury bonds that is a safe investment, people will put their capital into those treasury bonds, and then we can use those treasury bonds to encourage other economic activity. And one way the government's going to be doing that right now, they've just announced today, is they'll be issuing treasury bonds. They'll be collecting capital that's willing to put its money into a very safe investment. And then they will go out and buy the debt of corporations in order to finance day-to-day operations. Because companies are having trouble borrowing to finance their day-to-day operations. The state of California is having trouble borrowing to finance its day-to-day operations. It's liable to go to the federal government to borrow as well. Now, it's not that there's any sort of crisis in the state of California. The fact is, every government borrows throughout the year to pay for its operations while it waits for its tax revenues to come in, because those tax revenues all come in November. And the problem is, the state of California is going out to borrow, and there's no one willing to lend to it. But if the federal government can borrow and provide treasury bills, because there is a lot of capital out there, then the federal government can loan to the state of California. Just like corporations like Ford can't borrow to run its day-to-day operations, well, the federal government can issue treasury bills. There is capital sitting on the sidelines that would like to buy treasury bills. So that capital will come into the federal government, and then the federal government can loan money to afford to fund its day-to-day operations. One might argue that if the government is going to borrow to loan money to California, is going to borrow to loan money to major corporations like Ford and General Motors and Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, then presumably the federal government maybe should be willing to borrow in order to lend money to students who are having trouble getting traditional non-government guaranteed student loans, which has become an increasingly important way in which students finance their college education because, of course, the limits on government loans have grown so much more slowly than the cost of attending college.
We're speaking with Professor Stephen L. Ross at the University of Connecticut in the Economics Department. We also had the opportunity to ask a question of Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey during a conference call for the Obama campaign. I asked Senator Casey and others whether or not the $700 billion bailout plan eliminates any of the social programs that are being outlined by Barack Obama. This is what he said.
From my own perspective here, you can get more detail from the Obama campaign. The $700 billion that has been talked about, first of all, is not the authority only goes halfway. It only goes to 350. Even if there was authority for all $700 billion today, this is debt money. In other words, the general fund impact, the same fund that pays for Medicare, Medicaid, defense, education, everything, veterans benefits, that's general fund money. And basically what you're paying there is debt service on the $700 billion. You're not paying, it's not a $700 billion drain out of the general fund, and I think that's been lost on a lot of people.
Let me ask you, Professor Ross, what are your thoughts about the overall consequences of this economic emergency and this bailout?
The next president is going to be able to do very little. Just with this bailout bill, we've eaten an amount of debt that is equivalent to everything we spent on the Iraq War. We were running large deficits before that. And we are approaching the retirement of the baby boom. We know that Social Security is expected to be insolvent about 2025. We can't afford Social Security given the current revenue structure. So you only have three choices. You can delay when people get Social Security to make the pool smaller. You can give people on Social Security less money. Or you can raise more revenue. Or you can borrow. So you have four choices. Give people Social Security for less time. Give them less money when they're on Social Security, raise more money to pay for Social Security and Medicare, or borrow to finance the insolvency. So far, the politicians are unwilling to cut Social Security benefits, they're unwilling to delay the retirement age, and they're unwilling to either raise payroll taxes or remove the cap so that more income will be subject to payroll taxes, raising more revenue. Truth is, the insolvency is large enough that the only way to balance it is to do all three. But we're really heading towards borrowing to finance it because all three seem unacceptable to the American populace that puts politicians in office. And so the basic default plan has been to borrow to finance the Social Security deficit. We can't afford to do that anymore. We will have thrown away almost $1 trillion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there's $2.5 trillion that could have been used to borrow to help finance the Social Security and Medicare insolvency, but it's gone.
John McCain, who has a certain amount of wealth, has already started collecting Social Security. What about the so-called opt-out plans for wealthier individuals?
If you allow people to opt out, the high earners who subsidize the system will opt out, and Social Security will get more bankrupt. The proposals for privatization essentially are opt-out proposals. They cost money. They don't make money for the system. And because they cost money, they make the insolvency worse. The only solution is to raise more money, narrow the base of people who receive it by delaying the retirement age, or decrease benefits. Truth be told, you probably need to do all three.
Just walk us through the financial crisis and Treasury Secretary Paulson's initial plan.
Things changed about a month ago. We changed from a world where the Treasury Secretary thought that we could solve our problems by introducing liquidity, by lending money to companies. And by lending money to companies, we would make those companies more liquid, we would make those companies more stable, and then they would be able to go out and do business in the financial markets and lend to various people who need credit, whether they be mortgage holders, students, or industrial firms. That hasn't worked. The credit has started to seize up, capital has become sitting on the sidelines, in spite of the fact that we've infused over the last year a tremendous amount of liquidity into the system and have added a lot of stability to the financial sector. Treasury Secretary Paulson, I believe, came to the conclusion that the problem wasn't liquidity, it was solvency. The problem was that many of our financial institutions only had, to start with, anywhere between 3 and 10% equity or stockholder value. The rest of the company was debt. And when they had lost, you know, 5 to 15% of the value of their firm because they made risky bets in the financial markets, they were suddenly underwater. These companies owed more to debt holders than they were worth. So these companies are essentially insolvent. And there's actually a lot of evidence that insolvent companies behave differently than solvent companies, and they often don't behave the way we'd like them to. The best example of insolvent companies acting in inefficient ways is the savings and loan crisis, where banks became insolvent, they weren't shut down, and they started taking lots of risks and became more and more and more insolvent. What appears to be happening here is that because these companies are insolvent and they're facing pressures in terms of balancing their books, they're not lending. They're trying to recapitalize on their own, and that's causing credit to dry up. Paulson's solution, which I actually am not a big fan of, I don't think it's a very systematic solution. Paulson's solution is essentially, well, if we're going to have to bribe these firms to recapitalize, essentially, give me $700 billion, I will buy assets from them, most likely at more than those assets are worth, and because I'm overpaying for these assets, these companies will get extra money, and that will help make these companies solvent again. And he's not going to say it in that way, but essentially we are bribing the companies to recapitalize because they're not willing to recapitalize on their own once they're insolvent.
What can compel any of the bank CEOs or financial institution investors to adhere to any of the proposals, rules, or suggestions?
A better question to ask is what incentives do they face when the firms are insolvent and their fortunes are tied to the value of the firm's stock? And the real incentive is when a company's insolvent and you're interested in the value of the firm's stock, you want to hold on to all this capital in case things turn around. Because if you liquidate, it's worth zero, you get nothing. But if you can hold on to the capital, things might turn around. And so many of these financial institutions have basically put themselves into a holding position, waiting for things to turn around, hoping that their insolvent company, if things turn around, the assets will increase in value, and they will become solvent again, and their stock shares will be worth something. The question is how to add solvency back to the system. As I said, Secretary Paulson's plan is essentially one where we don't want to make anybody do anything, so we're going to have to bribe them by offering them a lot of money in order to get them to add this capital and become solvent again. There are other solutions out there that are more systematic, which will be more effective, which would cost the taxpayer a lot less money. But in order for those solutions to work, the government has to be more heavy-handed. The government has to say, we know that you're insolvent. We know that you're going to behave in an inefficient manner when you're insolvent. And so we're going to have to intervene and make you solvent again so that you will start acting like financial firms are supposed to act like. There's a finance professor at the University of Chicago who has a plan which it basically incorporates that type of strategy. It requires an audit of financial companies to determine their level of insolvency and then requires debt, the people who loan those companies money, to convert a share of their debt to equity. Basically, what they would do is they would forgive part of the debt in the company, and in exchange, they would get stock in the company. And what that would do is if a company owes $100 million and is only worth $80 million, if you require the forgiving of $30 million worth of debt and then hand the bondholders stocks in exchange, suddenly this company is no longer insolvent. Suddenly it has a 10% equity stake. Who owns that equity stake? The people who lent money to these companies. Now, of course, that imposes a high cost on the stockholders. It's the stockholders who took the risk. It's the stockholders in these financial companies who should lose this money, not the U.S. taxpayer. But obviously, no one willingly accepts a loss. If you went to the casino and put $100 down and you lost it, and you were told, well, you can either lose this or you can pick it back up and walk away, you would pick it back up and walk away. Well, essentially, right now, unless we're willing to pass a law which is more heavy-handed in terms of the financial sector, they're not going to take this loss, right? They're going to sit on their losses. They're going to control their capital and hope things turn around. And you can only make them recapitalize by mandating it, by a more heavy-handed action of the federal government.
There is a Professor Luigi Zingales.
Is his plan, yes.
Okay. There's an op-ed in the Financial Times. He says why Paulson is wrong. That's
correct. Basically, Paulson was reevaluating his strategy. Both Paulson and the Federal Reserve were following a strategy of trying to both maintain discipline, requiring stockholders to bear the losses of the risk they took, but at the same time, keep the financial sector operating and liquid. And the way they were doing that was by being willing to lend large amounts of money to keep operating financial companies operating. And when a company got in trouble, they were willing to provide loan guarantees, provide loans in exchange for equity in order to basically keep these companies, again, operating, keeping these companies liquid, but at the same time, basically making sure that the stockholders in these companies didn't benefit. What happened was in the midst of all of this, in the midst of infusing hundreds of billions of dollars into the financial system, credit market continued to tighten. Firms stopped lending. And you have to ask yourself, if you're infusing hundreds of billions of dollars of liquidity into the market, and in spite of that, no one is willing to lend, then there's a problem, right? And basically, Secretary Paulson came to the conclusion, and I agree with him, that the problem seemed to be that these financial firms were insolvent. And because they were insolvent, they were basically starting to sit on the sidelines and not participate in credit markets. They were basically saying, we're going to hold pat, and we are going to only take very low-risk action because anything could tip us over the edge where we'd be closed down. And our only hope of getting any money out of this company is to not get closed down and hold on to the capital until things turn around. That's not what we want companies to be doing, but that's what these insolvent companies were doing. And so the conclusion was, we need to make them solvent again. The secretary came up with this plan that would make them solvent again, that he thought they would participate in voluntarily, but the only way to get them to participate voluntarily is to make it worth their while. And the only way to make it worth their while is to have them make money on the deal, to have them sell us these mortgage-backed securities for less than they're worth. And, you know, you could see that when Secretary Paulson was testifying on Congress. Congress wanted to know, why would we buy these mortgage-backed securities and not at least get some equity stake in the company? And Paulson said, well, you don't want to do that because if you insist on taking stock in the company in exchange for buying these mortgage-backed securities, it's not going to look as good as good a deal, and the companies aren't going to want to participate. And he's right, but that sort of begs the question, if they won't participate in what is the needed action, there are two solutions. And one is to essentially bribe them to participate, make it worth their financial interest to participate by essentially giving them a substantial gift that will make them solvent. And the other is to make them participate, to have legislative action to require these companies to be recapitalized by a careful marking of all assets to the market value and then the forgiving of debt and the issuing of stock to debt holders. It would be a path that would be far more systematic than the Paulson plan. It would guarantee that all of these companies were solvent when we were done. Then they would likely go back to doing what they did, which was lend, and it would cost the taxpayer much less money. Even with the Paulson bill passed, this would be a good policy to pursue. If companies know that they are going to be subject to this financial audit, they're going to be subject to recapitalization, they will be even more anxious to sell their mortgage-backed securities. The government will get a better price on their mortgage-backed securities.
How much of what we're seeing in the markets today has to do with deregulation by politicians of Wall Street and the banking sector?
From my perspective, we have had too much deregulation. And this is an opinion, obviously. I should say that I think the Democrats and the Republicans are sort of complicit in this. I think we have had a Congress and an administration that have good relationships with the financial sector. It was in their interest to allow the financial sector to profit from unregulated economic activity, in spite of the fact that that unregulated economic activity led to individuals taking very high levels of risk, and worse, it was sort of systematic risk. No one was watching the fort saying, look, when one person takes a risk, it's not a problem. But if everyone takes the same risk and they all guess wrong, then the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. Most of the financial institutions that were very large were unregulated, the major investment banks. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were regulated, but they did not face a lot of scrutiny. They were allowed to buy mortgage-backed securities as investment that were rated AAA, but in fact, those mortgage-backed securities were backed by risky subprime loans, and the only reason they were rated AAA was because they had various gimmicky credit enhancements that were intended to make them safer, but really were not worth the ink that was used to type up the credit enhancements. You know, there was no one in the federal government who was willing to stand up and say, these credit enhancements really aren't worth anything. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae is not allowed to invest in low-quality debt. No one was willing to go to the rating agencies and say, how can you know that these mortgages that are backed by, you know, very risky subprime loans is really AAA paper? So yes, I think there was a tremendous failure of oversight in terms of the financial sector. Basically, what you want to do is you want to say that there are certain extremes that are completely out of bounds, and you want to put up a fence so that you can't go to these very extreme outcomes that are out of bounds, and then you want to allow the free market to operate in a fairly unfettered manner within this fence. And the problem was that in sort of getting rid of awkward, poorly thought out regulations, no one ever really took seriously erecting the fence. So essentially what you were trying to do is you were trying to take the chain off your pet so that they could run more freely and enjoy your yard more. But when you remove the chain, you have to realize that you have to build the fence.
Now, we know you're not a financial advisor, but Stephen L. Ross, do you have any kind of suggestion for investors, students, and their families, everyone listening?
You know, in general, most investment professionals will tell you right now to sit still because you never want to sell in the middle of a crisis when stocks are falling. The problem, of course, is that right now we don't know whether the crisis will get worse and stocks will fall further, or the crisis will stabilize and stocks will recover. Maybe it's a coin flip. Now, in the long run, there is clear advice that investment professionals give. What they want you to be is they want you to be diversified. And the best way to be diversified is to put money in various mutual funds. Put some money into bonds, some money into stocks. Have some of that money that's in stocks diversified outside of the U.S. economy. Now, in terms of thinking about college, what you always want to remember is that you need to adjust your portfolio as you start to approach needing the money. If you have a bunch of money that you put aside for college, when your kid is a couple years away from college, most of that money needs to have been moved out of risky stocks and into safe government treasuries. Because if you have a 10-year time horizon, usually you can just ride out any sort of economic downturn. But if you have a 2-year time horizon, you can't. You know, if I had been speaking to someone who was approaching retirement and giving them advice 2 years ago about what they should be doing, I should say, well, you need to look at the money you need over the next 4 or 5 years. You don't want all your money out of the stock market because you need growth. You're going to live for the next 20 years. But at least for the money you need the next 4 or 5 years, you better have that money in fairly safe places like bonds, and you better have some of it in a very safe place like a money market or a CD. You don't know whether the market's going to go up or down. But if you need the money over the next couple of years, you need to get that money out and in your hands where it's not going to be at risk of major losses in the stock market. And the reason you take the risk of having money in the stock market where it could go down a lot or it could go up a lot is because you know that you've got a long time horizon. And over 10 years, you can afford to expose yourself to that risk. And so that's the standard strategy. As you're saving for college, as college starts approaching, you shift more and more of that money into bonds, into CDs, into safe investments. But when your kids are 3, you need growth, and you have most of that money in the stock market.
Stephen L. Ross teaches at the University of Connecticut in the Economics Department in the area of public finance. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.